they wouldn't on the side, no?
Yeah, I fixed them on that side. It is 11 a.m. This is Registrar Stakeholder Part 2 in Tube Call.
Could you please just once say something up and pop?
This guy, sorry.
Okay, everybody, if you could try to take your seats, we're going to start up again in about a minute or two. Okay, everybody, could you please take your seats? We're going to restart the meeting. This is the Registrar Stakeholder Group meeting. If you're looking for somebody else, you're in the wrong room. Please take your seats. Okay, everybody, this is Registrar Stakeholder Group meeting. Could we please restart recordings and all those other funky things? Okay, thank you. Over to you, Darcy, I think. No, maybe? Okay, sorry. Mr. Zupke, you have the floor.
Thank you, Michele. This is Mike Zupke of staff, but I'm really here to turn over the microphone to my colleague Fabienne on the Registry Services team, who is heading up the implementation of the Thick Who Is policy recommendations. So I'll just step down and hand it over to Fabienne.
Hello, everyone. My name is Fabienne Betremieux. I'm from the Registry Services team. I think we're here to discuss the Thick Who Is policy implementation, and in particular, from the perspective of what will be the impact on the registrars and regarding input we'd like to seek from the registrars, stakeholder group, and the registrars for us to refine the implementation plan. So maybe we can move to the next slide that will just provide with an overview of the background, and then I'll turn it over to Theo regarding the discussion on the input that we're seeking. So as you may be aware, the Thick Who Is PDP started in 2012 and concluded in October 2013 with the policy recommendations that were produced, adopted by the board in February of 2014. In terms of outcome of the implementation, we've identified two outcomes: the transition from thin to thick of .com.net and .jobs, and the consistent labeling of display for all GTLDs per the specification 3 of the RA 2013. In terms of the discussion of the transition from thin to thick, the IRT has suggested that we consider two parallel tracks. So we would seek in parallel, and with each of those tracks would have a specific timeline, we would work on a track which would transition the new registrations, so registrations created after the policy effective date, and the other track would be the transition of existing registrations. And I think the proposal behind those two tracks is the rationale for that proposal is that those two types of registration would potentially create specific challenges that would need to be managed appropriately. And so the reason we're here is really to seek your input on, in particular, the second track of existing registrations, so that we can inform the definition of the implementation plan. Can I turn it over to you, Theo, with the next slide, maybe?
Sure, Fabienne, thank you. So basically, the IRT is facing a couple of questions here on how to move forward. And that's why we're here to ask the registrars to provide their input on it, because wherever we were going with this, there will be operational impact some way or another. And the scope of the questions is pretty broad. From a sense, there is a lot of open questions here, and the IRT, the members in it, do not have the answers. So we need to come back to you guys and basically put out a question like, guide us here and help us and see where we go, where we are going with this. So I think that's basically the question for this session here.
And so I think we shared with the group a scoping paper for a potential analysis of data that you registrars are currently holding in your records. The objective, and this is in relation to the transition of existing registrations, the objective of this analysis of data would be to identify the type of challenges that we would face when transitioning those registrations from thin to thick. And not only identify but also quantify those issues that we may face. And the and so that would serve to define the type of expectation requirements that we should put on the transition, the timeline, and any types of supporting measures that would be needed to complete the transition. The nature of the analysis would be to look at the existing registration data and compare it to requirements from the registries and requirements existing in the various contracts that would be applicable to the end state, which would be a thick .com, .net, and .jobs. So in the scoping paper, we've provided proposed systems requirements from the registries, so applicable to .com, .net, and .jobs. And the purpose of the analysis would be to look at how the current data that are on your records compare to those requirements and the type of problems that you would face as an affected party when transferring that data to the registry in the context of that transition to thick. And in terms of participation, what we're hoping to have is 10 to 20 volunteers that would be willing to contribute such analysis and look at a sample of their data and provide those types of findings that we're looking for. And so maybe to the bottom of the slide here, we've discussed with the IRT some types of challenge without this being an exhaustive list. So we expect that there would be potential missing data or incompatible data format. So for instance, you'd have dates or phone numbers that would not be compatible with what the registry would expect. Some data may be missing, incomplete data, or there may also be issues with your ability to potentially contact a registrant to get some data you would need for the transition. So those are initial ideas of type of challenges that we may face. But again, we're seeking your input and your own analysis into identifying and quantifying those type of issues. So I think we can open it up for questions.
So this is Tom Barrett from Inserca. As registrars, we're all required to do data escrow, even for the thin TLDs. We're all required to have a local Whois database for the thin TLDs. And we've all gone through an audit by ICANN compliance who have probably confirmed that we're collecting the right data for the Whois, that we're collecting the right data for data escrow. So I guess I'm confused why you think there's going to be challenges of this sort unless we're not already following our RAA and wasn't caught during an audit, or perhaps you could discover this yourself by looking at the Iron Mountain data escrow and see if this type of problem exists.
Just hold on a second. I'm going to take a comment from remote first. Caitlin.
Thank you, McKaylee. This is Caitlin Tubergen speaking for Frank Miklick. Comment is, I don't think it's a good idea to split the migration between old and new records. It would mean registrars need to implement checking for contact changes to see which group the domains belong to. It seems to be simple to do a migration based on a per registrar basis, which I believe is how it was done for .org.
Thank you. Any reaction?
What?
No, that wasn't aimed at you. It was more towards Fabien.
So I don't mean to represent the IoT here. I'm just the staff supporting the work of the implementation here. So I'm not the only one that can certainly answer to the question. And I'm looking to my colleagues from the IoT here, Frederic and Theo. So to the comment, I think that's I'm not exactly sure of how deeply this was discussed with the IRT, the possibility to consider a registration on a registrar per registrar basis, but currently the proposal from the IRT, including several representatives of registrars, is to consider proceeding with two tracks existing in your registration. So I think the commenter should certainly get closer to the work here and help us understand what would be the benefits of this approach compared to potential drawbacks of the current proposed approach. Frédéric or Theo, do you want to add something?
Yeah, Frédéric Guillemot, member of the IRT. I think you're right, we're supposed to have the right data. But as it's also a good opportunity for us to remove the last thin registry and to be able to have all registries equal, and maybe that will allow us at some point to remove the data escrow obligation and the WHOIS obligations. That would be also a possibility. But it will be a challenge because, I mean, if you have data, you have to transfer that to the re-signed registry. We've discovered that there some of the fields are not mandatory. Some of the fields might have some different formats. And when we will have to fill in their database, I mean, you know, it never goes 100% right. Or maybe it's just me, but so there will be some challenge. And we will have to do it, and we will have to do some testing and working together.
Okay, I saw a few hands there earlier. I think, Tom, you may have had a hand up, but I think, are you okay?
Well, so I had a few questions. So why can't they just look at the data escrow data and determine where the problems are?
Michele, they don't have a right to, essentially. The data escrow only exists for a very specific purpose. So to answer you, to be blunt, if you went out of business, then they could look at it, but until you do, they can't. I know that may seem a bit crazy, but I think that's basically the way it's set up. I mean, somebody else can correct me. Theo?
You're correct, Michele. And Tom, the suggestion is really, really good there. And we looked at it, and we thought it was not a solution there. But basically, what we are seeking is to get answers to these questions, because we do not know how well the data is at the registrars. I've been involved in several migrations from different registrars to our database, and the first thing we have to do when a registrar supplies us with data is we need to script it in the correct format according to the RA 2013, because there is some really old data there, and to avoid any display issues, we need to script it. And that's just a practical issue there. And if you have a team of developers on your side, okay, that's brilliant. They can script it. But if you are a registrar who has to rely on maybe external developers, you're going to have an issue there, because a VeriSign expects it in a certain format according to an RFC. So it has to be in that format. And that's just one of the practical challenges that we are facing here. Thanks.
And to add another point to that, Frédéric speaking for the record. I also thought it was a good idea for VeriSign to use a data escrow. No work for us. But when I proposed that, some other registrars were not very keen on having VeriSign taking their data, because of confidentiality reasons or so on. So some registrars apparently don't feel at ease with giving the key to their data to VeriSign.
And
which is what will happen with a thick WHOIS.
Okay. I have some remote comments, Caitlin.
Thank you, Michele. First remote comment is from Rob Golding of Astudium. We will need exemption from WHOIS complaints during and for a significant period after the implementation. And this needs to be done on a TLD by TLD basis. Jobs, then net, then com. Second comment from Frank Micklick. The escrow data format can vary quite a bit from registrar to registrar. And why there are now under the 2013 RAA rules for WHOIS output format, it really only applies to the field names as far as I know, but not to format and length of the fields.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Greiman.
Yes, thank you. Michaela Fucker-Greiman speaking, his name for the record. I think the current planning that foresees a multi-stage transfer is not the ideal situation, because that would mean that we would have to have two, at worst three, parallel systems running at the same time that provide WHOIS data or not. That would have to switch at certain points, look at the registration dates and so on. So that's not ideal. What we're looking for as a registrar would be a cutoff date at what time WHOIS provision would be switched from the registrar to the registry. Data collection and data transfer can happen before that, and then a delta could be sent that would just have the updated data between the first transfer and the last transfer, and then that would be done. Second point, with the escrow data, I agree that the escrow data is not the ideal situation. First, the contract is set up in a way that the escrow data cannot be used for that purpose. Second is that the escrow data contains actually more data than what is currently available in the WHOIS. For example, we are also required to escrow underlying registrant data for WHOIS privacy services that we operate that would have to be that is currently escrowed but would not be reflected, of course, in the data that would be sent to VeriSign or the .jobs registry when we make the transfer. So it really has to depend on the data that we can send to the registry. And the third point that I would like to raise is that the registry maybe should not be too strict in what format to expect, but rather allow all possible formats as long as these formats are in some way conceivable to have the data in it. So the registry should, at the transfer point at least, not check that data is in the correct format, but rather is data there or not.
Okay, I'm going to go to remote and then to Theo.
Thank you, Michaela. Remote comment from Joyce Lynn. I do not see why escrow data should have anything to do with the implementation.
Theo?
This is Theo for the record. So just to piggyback on what Volker just said about that the requirements from the registry should be too strict. Actually, the situation currently is that the RFC has a couple of optional fields that actually cause some confusion amongst the registrars, because we as registrars, we have to comply with the RAA 2013 format output, and the RFC that VeriSign intends to use has several optional fields, and from what I've seen, but I'm not an expert there, is it looks pretty well in a sense like it's not too strict, but like I said, I'm not an expert. Thanks.
Ben, go ahead.
Yeah, Ben Anderson. Would it be possible to socialize that data? Sorry, I've not really kept up with this, but it would be good for the group to see those additional fields. And my other point is, sort of moving forward from this, I'd like to see a potential staging area from the registry where registrars can test data submission first, rather than having to do it all in one go and then deal with the problems afterwards.
And we have another comment from remote.
Thank you. Comment from Kelly Salter. Doesn't our data escrow also contain the underlying registrant data where we have provided our own privacy service?
Does anybody have a comment on that? Reaction? Answer? Go ahead.
Okay, this is for you for the record. And these questions are exactly the type of questions that we are facing in the IRT, and we do not have an answer, and that's why we should have a discussion about it, because people on the IRT from several other stakeholder groups are pushing for timelines, and that is the question there. What do we think is a reasonable timeline? So that those are the questions that we're dealing with, and we do not have the answers as an IRT, and I'm not sure even we registrars have the answer here, and that could be a possible outcome that we do not know also, and it might affect the timelines heavily, I guess. Thanks.
I have Graham from Demis, and then James, and then we're closing out this topic.
Graham from Demis. My understanding is that the privacy, the underlying data from the privacy should be in escrow, but obviously if we can't access escrow data, I think that's a bit of a moot point.
And James, I'm giving you the last word.
Thanks. It's probably the least helpful because I had to step out. It's James speaking, and I had to step out and come back twice, so I apologize if this has already been beat to death, but just generally speaking, I don't agree that we should involve the escrow at all in this process. That data is encrypted. We're supposed to turn that over in the event of deaccreditation or registrar business failure. It does contain additional data that's not necessary, so I feel like we need to leave that off the table. This is just my personal position. The second thing is for, it's going to be an operational challenge for registrars with a large legacy domain, and I think that, for us it makes the most sense if we tackle this update whenever it is a domain name is transferred or domain name is renewed. And then that gives us a timeline of 10 years minimum to get this whole thing done. Okay, and that's the timeline. I mean, if you're getting pressure from other groups, say, look, you know, it's going to be a long-tail problem. You're going to get a big chunk of it probably in the first year or two, and then it's going to trickle out for the next 10 years. But it doesn't make any sense to update hundreds of millions of records when some are going to expire and some are going to be, anyway, that's my thoughts, and I apologize if this is all well-covered ground by the IRT or even this conversation today.
Okay, thanks. We're going to move on. No, we're moving on. Sorry, Fred. If we can follow up with this on the members list, I know that quite a few of you have an interest in this. It is a topic that is of interest to a lot of you. Okay, next item up. We can flip a coin and see which one of you wants to lead on this. It's the change of registrant, which as part of the IRTPC implementation. And for those of you who are not au fait with all of the wonderful acronyms in the ICANN space, IRTP is basically domain transfers. If you go to icann.org/transfers, it'll redirect to the current policy. IRTP is inter-registrar transfer policy. So way back in the dawns of time, when Jeff Newman didn't have a beard or all sorts of other things were different, ICANN had a transfer policy, and there has been a series of four PDPs to review that policy. And quite a few people in this room have been involved in various parts of it. So IRTPC was the third of the PDPs on this. So I will hand over to Mike and Caitlin, and they can toss a coin as to who wants to speak. Over to you guys.
Thank you. This is Caitlin Tubergen for the transcript, and thank you, Michaeli, for that introduction. I know this is everyone's favorite topic. I think we can skip this slide, as Michaeli has already gone over this. I just did want to note that these changes do go into effect as of August 1st of this year. So if you take a look at the new policy, you'll notice that it's divided into two sections. The first section is what was then the inter-registrar transfer policy. There's been a change to that policy, and that deals with the FOAs, or the form of authorization. The FOA now expires under four circumstances, which are listed on the slide. The first is after a period of 60 days, though the registrar does have the option to allow the registered name holder to auto-renew the FOA. The second is if the domain name expires before the inter-registrar transfer is completed. Third, if there's been a change of registrant that's been completed prior to the inter-registrar transfer. And lastly, after the inter-registrar transfer is completed, the FOA would expire. So what that means is if the FOA does expire under any of these circumstances, the registrar would need to reauthorize that transfer via a new FOA.
Just actually just pausing for 1 second. Is there anybody here who doesn't know what an FOA is? Or are we all comfortable with that? I assume you all are. So I'm very conscious of acronym soup and people getting confused. Sorry, back to you, Caitlin.
Thank you, Michaela. Again, Caitlin Tubergen for the transcript. So the second part of the policy, the change of registrant, is the most significant change to the policy. And so I thought I'd start by going over a couple of definitions in that policy. So a change of registrant is defined as a material change to the prior registrant name, prior registrant organization, prior registrant email address, or the administrative contact email address if there is no prior registrant email address. And the prior registrant is simply defined as the registered name holder when the change of registrant is initiated. The new registrant is the entity or person to whom the prior registrant is transferring the name or proposes to transfer the name to. And in some situations, it may be the same entity. Material change is defined as a non-typographical change. And there's a couple more examples in the actual text of the policy.
Caitlin, are you taking questions?
I can take a question.
So if you go back a slide, this is Tom Barrett from Inserca. I want to make sure I understand bullet 4 here.
Tom, could you speak a bit more closely into the mic?
So I'd like to understand the scenario that you describe in bullet 4. When does that happen?
So when we were working on this with the implementation review team, one of the registrars in the group noted that for some older domain names, there might not be a registered name holder email address, but there may be an admin contact email address. So that would be a situation where there's a blank field for registrant email, but there is an email in the admin contact. I don't know how common of a scenario is, but how common that scenario is, but someone did raise that point. So that's why we added that language.
Vlad.
Vlad Nikolescu for the transcript. I'm trying to link these definitions to the FOA, because in the FOA you mentioned that if the registrant changes, then the FOA expires. So can I apply these definitions over here to the FOA definitions directly? So you're saying that if the organization changes while there's a transfer and an FOA out, then I have to cancel that transfer. Is that correct?
So the FOA would expire when the change of registrant is completed. Okay. So what we're going to go over in a few minutes is there is a whole process that happens when a change of registrant is requested. But once the new registrant is in the whois, that would mean that the FOA would need to be or would expire.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So Tom Barrett again from Inserca. So prior registrant, that second bullet, is that referring to what field is considered the prior registrant? Is that the name, organization, or email address?
Correct. So a change of registrant is defined only as a change to those three or four fields, depending on the situation. Any one of them, yes. So if a domain name was registered to Caitlin Tubergen, and I propose to change that to Mike Zupke, and that's the only thing I'm changing, that would be a change of registrant under this policy. Similarly, if I were to just change my email address, that would also be a change of registrant.
One follow-up question?
No, I'm giving it to Jeff, and I'll come back to you.
All right. Yeah,
thanks. Just also a question on number 4. I just want to make sure, again, I got this right. So if there is a change to the administrative contact email address, that does not count as a change of registrant. Is that correct?
That is mostly correct.
Okay, because I don't know. I think I don't want to speak for everyone, but I know a lot of systems that when we do the transfers, it goes on the administrative contact email address is the one that is. So that could be a giant loophole. So I just wanted to make sure and just, I don't know, if, I'm assuming most people use that method. So I wanted to make sure that the administrative contact change, if there, well, I'll let you continue because you said it's okay. Partially correct. So I'll let you go through on that later. Thanks. I just wanted to bring that up.
So generally speaking, if an admin contact email changes, that would not be a change of registrant. It would only be a change of registrant if the admin contact email changed and there was no email address in the registered name holder email field. Does that make sense?
I think so. I'll go to Jeff. Sorry, go to Tom in 1 second. Just so you're aware, the transfer policy for transfer domains, the hierarchy is registrant, then administrative contact. So the registrant is the one that is meant to authorize the transfer. If the registrant does not authorize the transfer, it's blocked. If they don't respond, the administrative contact can authorize it. Tom, over to you.
Okay, and I think I have it reversed to what you just said, but we'll get, that's a different topic.
No, it's not. What I said is correct.
Okay. So, Tom Barrett again from Usurca. I want to talk about typographical corrections. Can we rely on the registered name holder to assert that what they're changing is a typographical correction, or is there some other third-party judge of that?
Thanks for the question, Tom. This is Caitlin Tubergen for the transcript. That language was used to give registrars some flexibility into what would be an actual change. There are some examples in the implementation notes of what a typographical change might be. So there was some talk about registrars using some sort of algorithm to determine that, although others cautioned against that for reasons of international registrants, and it's unclear what might be a typographical change. I don't know that anyone mentioned that there would be some sort of button or some sort of option for the registrant to assert that it is only a typographical change, but that could certainly be something the registrar uses to show the registrant noted that this was just a typographical change. I also wanted to note that there was a question in the remote from Joyce Lynn, which was, is email change a material change?
Why?
Why is email change a material change? Thank you for that question, Joyce. The GNSO delivered this final report with recommendations, and it was clear that in the recommendation, what a change of registrant would be, and it was these three fields, and so that's why that's included in that definition.
I know this might be another comment from remote, Caitlin.
John Barry Hill, sorry, question. The summary of public comments on the IRT draft said, the implementation review team will be reviewing these comments and decide on a proposed course of action in the coming weeks. The ensuing discussion of the IRT mailing list contains a minor update, but no substantive discussion of the public comments, or desirable, undesirable changes in view of the comments. In what way have the public comments been taken into account in what was put forward as the final draft? Thank you for that comment/question, John. And I do want to say that the implementation review team did review all of the comments. I distinctly remember the comments from the registrar stakeholder group. And I'm not sure if you recall the first iteration of the policy. Theo probably recalls, James might recall as well, or other members of the implementation review team. But the first iteration of the policy that did go out for public comment in terms of the process that the change of registrant would take had a very prescribed way of doing that with a change of PIN to the prior registrant, the registrar, the new registrant, and registrars did ask for something that allowed them more flexibility. In particular, they asked if they could just do this via some sort of secure mechanism so that they could have a more flexible business practice and choose how to implement that. And so we did take note of that, and the policy was updated to account for those types of comments.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead, Heath.
Heath Dixon for the record. How does this work with customers that are under a privacy service? When you turn that off to change the name, and how does that affect the FOA and under the new policy?
Thank you for that question, Heath. Again, this is Caitlin Tubergen for the record. So I haven't gotten to the slides yet, but there is a whole process that needs to occur whenever there's what's considered a change of registrant. So if the registrant name field were to change because of the removal of a privacy or proxy service, that would be considered a change of registrant. However, there is a definition in the policy for a designated agent. And so the prior registrant and new registrant can authorize or explicitly allow a designated agent to authorize or approve a change of registrant on its behalf. So in that circumstance, there might be a privacy or proxy agent that would be the prior registrant's designated agent for purposes of approving a change of registrant.
This is Michele. Just bear in mind there is a, what are we calling it, a round table? Yes, there's a round table on Thursday, I believe. What time is that at, Caitlin?
That's correct. Again, this is Caitlin for the transcript. There is going to be a registrar-led roundtable discussion on all things transfer policy updates related, and that will be from 8 a.m. to 9:15 in the Roseri room. Some registrars have graciously volunteered to help go through the steps of the change of registrant and talk about practical implementation ideas for these. So it would be great if everyone could attend, and I'm happy to answer more questions at that session.
Thanks, Caitlin. And also, as well, bear in mind, we are currently working with our colleagues in the registry stakeholder group and with ICANN staff on drafting the agenda for the GDD summit in Amsterdam in May. And one of the suggestions that we've received and have given is that we are, focus around implementation of policies, operationalizing policies. So I suspect that this one might be one that will end up on the agenda. So, Caitlin, back to you again.
So, Michele, this is Mike Zupke. I just also wanted to point out that we've heard from a number of registrars that they won't be here Thursday to participate, but the session will be recorded and I believe also transcribed. So, if you miss it, it's unfortunate, but you will still be able to sort of take part in another way.
Yes, thanks. And as the former chair of the registrars, I won't be there either.
Thank you. Again, this is Caitlin Tubergen for the transcript. This slide details the process that's prescribed in the policy of what the registrar needs to do when there is a change of registrant or there is a change to the name, organization, or email address. So the first is to confirm that the name is eligible for a change of registrant. The policy does enumerate certain circumstances where a name would be ineligible. So, for example, if there's a UDRP complaint or a court order where the name should be locked, the customer cannot do a change of registrant. Second, the registrar needs to confirm via a secure mechanism that the new registrant has explicitly consented to the change of registrant. There are a couple examples of secure mechanism in the implementation notes to the policy. However, that's not an exhaustive list, so the registrars do have flexibility to determine what a secure mechanism is or how they're going to implement that. Next, the registrar needs to inform the prior registrant or designated agent, as the case may be, that if its final goal is to perform an inter-registrar transfer or to move the name to a different registrar and change the registrant, that it's advised to complete the inter-registrar transfer first to avoid triggering a 60-day inter-registrar transfer lock. And that 60-day inter-registrar transfer lock happens after a change of registrant is performed. Next, the registrar needs to confirm via secure mechanism that the prior registrant or designated agent has explicitly consented to the change of registrant. once the registrar receives the explicit consent from both the prior and new registrant, it needs to process the change of registrant within one business day. And next, the registrar needs to send a notification to the prior and new registrant. And there's some notification requirements in C.1.1.6. And lastly, the registrar needs to lock the name for 60 days, if applicable. So registrars can allow registrants to opt out of that 60-day inter-registrar transfer lock prior to the change of registrant request. If the registrant does not opt out of the 60-day lock, then the name needs to be locked from inter-registrar transfer for 60 days. And the working group's goal of the name locking was just in case an account was compromised, that the name stays at that registrar to prevent some sort of domain name hijacking. Are there any questions on any of those steps?
Hi, Tom Barrett from Encirca. So, yeah, I believe that there'll be a lot of customers who are simply trying to update their WHOIS information that fall into this process. So given that the prior registrant and the new registrant are essentially the same person, and let's say they're changing their organizational name but not their email address, can you explain in that scenario how they would explicitly consent to the change? Do they have to? Can there be one consent where they say, I'm both the old and the new, or do you want them to have to consent twice? Hey, I'm the old, I consent to this. Hey, I'm the new, I consent to this. What sort of process do you want routine WHOIS updates to follow?
Thank you for the question, Tom. Again, this is Caitlin Tubergen for the transcript. So the goal is that you've confirmed with the new registrant and the prior registrant that they've explicitly consented to this change. So there may be a situation where you can confirm that the entity is the same exact entity and that that entity has explicitly consented to the change. With one communication, sorry.
Okay, Jeff, you're up.
Thanks, Jeff Eckhouse here. So the question I have on reading through this is on section 3 on the 60-day lock period. So first I'll have one small complaint, and that is that right now a lot of registrars are not enforcing the 60-day lock on transfer registrant, and that's, so I've seen that has not been enforced and people aren't agreeing to it. So knowing that sort of in that environment, how would ICANN enforce a 60-day lock if the change of registrant and the secure mechanism happens within the registrar ecosystem? How would ICANN know about it and enforce that 60-day lock? Unless it was we're on the honor system, which is something, unfortunately, I can't say that works too well. Thank you.
Just Michele, for the record. Caitlin, can you address that? But I'm also a bit conscious of time. We're kind of running out.
Yes. Thank you, Michele. This is Caitlin again for the transcript. Thank you for the question, Jeff. The first thing I wanted to note is that this inter-registrar transfer lock following a change of registrant isn't effective until August 1st. But August 1st going forward, it would be effective. And I think that the way that ICANN would become aware of this is through its normal complaint channels. So if, for example, someone says, my name was hijacked, it was changed, I didn't consent to this, I didn't opt out of any sort of lock, now it's at a different registrar, then ICANN would be aware that the registrar was not locking the name per the transfer policy.
So, sorry, I know this is a follow-up because this is important. Does that mean that ICANN would then, if somebody did not and the transfer was not authorized, ICANN would enforce a transfer undo process? Because that doesn't seem to be a process right now. And would they then work with the registries? And is that in their contracts to enforce an undo of a transfer? Thank you.
Jeff, this is Mike Zupke to respond, and I'm sort of channeling our compliance team. And in general, the remedy, you know, if there's a breach of the agreement or a breach of one of the policy requirements, sort of varies depending on what happens. So the compliance team would say, what's your remediation plan for this? The remediation plan might be, we'll, you know, work to get the domain name transferred back, or it might be, we'll work with the new registrar to ensure that the registrar gets control of domain name again. But that's sort of handled as it arises. So there's not necessarily something in this policy explicitly that says we'll require you to undo it or will require registries to take a particular action.
No, I'm not in the queue. Yeah.
Can we just flag this for the workshop? Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, look, guys and ladies and everything else, it's great that people are actively engaged on this topic. If you can make it along to the session on Thursday morning, it's designed to allow you to get into the nitty-gritty, into those fine details, to ask those awkward questions and to hopefully get some responses. Now, I personally suspect that no matter how much gets done on Thursday morning, it won't be enough and that we may need to look at, you know, conducting other, I don't know, virtual workshops or something, because it's not a simple change. It's complicated. It's complex. We're aware of that. Mike and Caitlin and their team is aware of it. I hope that compliance is aware of this, that it's on their radar. Is it on compliance's radar? Okay, for the transcript, both Mike and Caitlin did nod their heads, but since neither of them were wearing bells, that didn't get into the recording. Okay, so going back to our agenda, and thank you guys, very helpful. Our agenda now is we have a break for a few minutes. Lunch is being served in here, is that correct, Darcy? So lunch is being served in here. The lunch is being provided for members of the Registrar Stakeholder Group, as in you pay to be a member of the Registrar Stakeholder Group, which helps to pay for the lunch. So therefore, members of the stakeholder group get priority on the lunch. If there will probably be stuff left over, I'm not sure how this is set up today. Is it packed?
Session.
Oh, it's a closed session. Oh, beg your pardon. Yes, so let's make that clear. If you are not a member of the stakeholder group, at this juncture, I'm going to politely but firmly ask you to leave the room. And then I will then unleash people to move you physically from the room. This is a closed, we're moving into a closed session, which is for registrar stakeholder group members only. If you are a registrar and you are not a member of the stakeholder group, please come and speak to Darcy immediately or we will kick you out. For recordings and all that, you might want to pause them for now as we're going to take a break while they set up for lunch. So this is a working lunch, people. Thank you.